Cars, start your engines!
Hit the pace car! What for? Because you hit every other damn thing out there, I want you to be perfect!
When I'm driving, I got a guy on the radio who talks to me. You can see him, but he talks to me.
He didn't slam you, he didn't bump you, he didn't nudge you, he rubbed you. And rubbin' son is racing.
Hey, race fans, welcome to the Hoobazoo Radio Network and welcome to Drafting the Circuits. My name is Frank Santoroski. I'll be your host for the next hour as we run through this week in racing and preview next week. In the studio tonight is Mr. Seth Eggert from Motorsports Tribune, Richard Uden from Aruge Engineering, Gray Warren from Richard Childress Racing. How is everybody tonight?
Doing good.
Thank you.
Let's knock out the headlines real quick because we have a guest waiting in the wings. Kyle Busch making it four different winners in NASCAR in four different races. And the IndyCar had their season opener with Joseph Newgarden taking that initial win, getting his season off to a great start. A lot of drama in qualifying in both series, which we'll get into later in the show. But before we do that, I want to introduce to you our guest. I have with us Derek DeBoer. Drives the number 17 Porsche Cayman for the Racers Group in the Pirelli Challenge GT4 America Series. And he's also the star of Fast Life, which is a reality television program that airs on Amazon Prime. Derek, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing tonight?
Well, thanks a lot for having me. I'm doing good. I'm with you guys, and we're going to talk about racing. So there's nothing I'd rather be doing.
So first off, let's talk about your 2019 season. You guys have run at COTA. You're running the Sprint X class, which means you have a couple of co-drivers. Your teammates are Jim Rappaport, Dr. Jim Rappaport, and Sean Gibbons. You are with the Racing Group, and that's Kevin Buckler's team. And you've been with them for several years now. I believe 2013 is when you first signed on with the team. And you've come back. So tell me a little bit about the team dynamic there and how, you know, how nice it feels to have that same opportunity again and again, year after year.
Yeah, I really have to pinch myself each morning when I wake up because there's not a finer endurance racing team in the world, I don't think. And to have met them back when I did in 2013 and be starting my sixth season with them is something I'm really proud of, to have that, you know, just level of trust and belief in each other. And it's really just become like a family, and, you know, clearly things are clicking. They keep letting me come back. So I'm in.
Now you've done a couple of WeatherTech starts. You know, we get a lot of drivers on the program, and a lot of the stories are the same when we ask, how did you get into racing? And it's all like, you know, my dad bought me a shifter cart when I was six, and then I was on the road to racing. But you do come from a racing family, but you didn't make the plunge to really, you know, set your career sights on being a professional race car driver until much later in life. Do you think that's hurt you, helped you, or?
Yeah, my path is definitely a little bit different than most, and honestly, I wouldn't be here if my wife hadn't asked me one simple question one night while we were laying in bed. She said, "What passion do you want to chase in your life that I've not heard about yet?" And I said, "Well, I've always wanted to be a professional race car driver." And she was surprised. She'd never heard that. She said, "Well, then that sounds like something we need to chase." And that was 20 years ago. I hadn't set foot in a race car. And she signed me up for a 3-day Skip Barber Formula Dodge Racing School. And that was really where it began. I certainly grew up looking up to the sport. You know, I followed racing. I didn't follow football, baseball, basketball. You know, my heroes were the Danny Sullivans and the Mario Andretti's, and certainly looked up to my dad as well, who was a drag racer. So I got to follow him around a bit on the drag racing circuit.
Speaking of your wife now, she's you know, asked you to chase your dream, right? Now, her dream is to be a filmmaker. And now we have this wonderful television program that airs on Amazon called Fast Life, and it provides. I've watched all of season one, half of season two, which just dropped recently, but it provides a very intimate look at your guys' life. I mean, we can see everything from the, you know, the joy of winning the Aston Martin Festival at Le Mans to the fear and the anxiety about a sponsor who's defaulted on the payment. So, and I've talked to some other folks that have worked in reality television, and one of the things that a recurring theme is that sometimes they feel just exposed because their whole life is out there and they run into perfect strangers who just feel like they know them. Have you had any experience like that where it's been a bit uncomfortable, or has it been all mainly positive?
We have had some of that, and it's hard to get used to, and it was also hard for a while to get used to just the camera rolling all the time. There was some comfort in it, in that it was Brooke filming, and I always knew that if there was something that shouldn't be aired, she would probably err on that side of caution, although she's really just kind of put it all out there. But yeah, there have been moments where you bump into somebody on the street in New York City, and they know who you are or what you've done, or even just recently, you know, I'll walk into a place of business and somebody goes, "Did you purchase the white shoes or the black shoes?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And it was, you know, something that my wife had shared on her face, you know, Fast Life story or something like that. They didn't know we were being watched, but it really has been awesome, and it's been a really neat project, and it's been rewarding to see her getting to do what she loves on the side of what I'm doing that I love so much. And the fact that she kind of gave me that gift to chase this dream, there's not really a better combination, I don't think.
No, I mean, when you really look at it, it's actually very inspirational. How many folks, you know, out there that have these dreams that they haven't, you know, kind of pounced on, and, you know, both of you are making that happen. Seth, you have a question?
Yes, I do. As you mentioned, Derek, your father was in top alcohol dragsters. I know your grandfather also raced a little bit on dirt. And your wife, when you said you wanted to follow your dream, your wife bought you a 3-day Skip Barber test, essentially. How do you find your way into sports car racing?
You know, My initial path or dreams were to race in an Indy car. I mean, it was all single seater, open wheel formula stuff. And I met a gentleman along the way shortly after my kind of this, I'd done the Skip Barber stuff. I did a full season of Skip Barber and Formula Dodge. And then I ended up talking my way into a test in Formula Renault when the 2-liter cars were coming over here to North America. It was literally, I think I had done one Skip Barber race at that point in time. So I was probably jumping into something well over my head. But Pierre Phillips was the gentleman who was running this program in the Northwest. And, you know, turns out to have been a pretty large influence in lots of open wheel guys' experience. And he just always told me, he said, "Derek, stay in these single seaters as long as you can. Keep learning as much in this as you can, because you're going to be really fast when you make the transition to a sports car." So I stayed with it as long as I could, but it became very clear that seats and opportunities were becoming very limited. You know, unless you had a really, really large checkbook or the right last name behind you and the type of the sport that came with that. You know, I was racing with Marco Andretti and in Formula Renault and some of these guys, and it was really clear when I saw them just instantly move on to IndyCar, and I had no type of budget or ability to get there, that I needed to look on the other side of the fence and started looking at sports car. You know, I'm looking at, you know, at that point in time, there's fields of 75 cars starting the Daytona, you know, the 24 hours of Daytona, and 3 or 4 drivers a car. And I'm like, the odds look a lot better on that side of the fence of finding one of those seats.
Speaking of the 24 hours of Daytona, going back to 2015, I believe one of your co-drivers was Elio Salazar, Formula One driver, IndyCar driver, and I'm sure some of your other co-drivers have also competed in Formula One, IndyCar, NASCAR, etc. Have you ever tried to use any of those connections to do a one-off in another series, whether it's IndyCar, NASCAR, etc.?
You know, I probably haven't leveraged that as good as I could, and certainly, you know, those types of things are just things that become normal when you're dealing with Kevin Buckler and TRG. He just keeps putting you with people and opportunities that I think I would have never met along the way. I mean, what a treat to get to have shared a car with Eliseo, and my first 24-hour Daytona experience couldn't have really been better than what we experienced there.
And what kinds of stories have you shared with some of your co-drivers that you can share with us anyway? Just some of these stories I can imagine, whether it's a Formula One, IndyCar, etc.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, now having been with the team for six seasons, I've kind of been one of the regular fixtures there. So I get a chance to kind of work with the revolving door of drivers that happens, you know, today in endurance sports cars. So I have had a lot of amazing experiences with a whole handful of different guys, and, you know, the things that we get to do together, you know, even off of the racetrack, you know, it's one of the things I love about racing is there's just such a group of passionate people that are in the sport with similar drive in the other parts of their lives. So almost every time you meet a race car driver, there's something else awesome tied to them. And I've just ended up with handfuls of awesome buddies off the track.
Great. You said you had some questions.
Yeah, Derek, for our listeners, tell us about the Pirelli World Challenge. Tell us about the series and the class that you run in.
Yeah, so Pirelli World Challenge is where I got my feet wet with TRG. My first race ever with them was Pirelli World Challenge at their home track, Sonoma Raceway in Sonoma, California. And I've mainly ran in the GT4 class. So GT4 is classification cars. They're more close to a production car than a GT3 car. You know, almost every manufacturer now that's involved in racing is producing a GT3 car as well as a GT4 car. You know, they look like a car that you can go buy on the showroom floor. And I think that's part of what makes Pirelli World Challenge so relevant for the fans. You know, we've got people that are able to watch cars go bang doors together that they're aspiring to own, you know, whether it's an Aston Martin or Porsche, Ferrari, Lamborghini, BMWs, you know, Chevy Camaros and Ford Mustangs. It's all out there together. So the series has changed quite a lot, you know, since I first started driving in 2013. You know, at that point in time, it was multi-class racing. We had two classes. We had GT3 cars and GT4 cars on the track at the same time. It then moved to splitting those up. And then the Sprint X, you know, concept has come along, which is World Challenge's version of endurance racing. It's a two-driver format with a 10-minute window in the middle of the race where we're required to make a pit stop and a driver change. You know, I've always enjoyed endurance racing. I like the team concept of it, sharing a car with the driver. The driver change, all that is a really important part of sports car racing to me. So to have that format in World Challenge, I think, has been a real success. And I've seen the field growing, the talent in the field growing, the competition is better than it's ever been. And, you know, it's a really, really great series to be involved with.
Typically, how many cars are in a typical field for a race?
You know, probably in the 30 to 40 car fields would be pretty normal.
That's a sign of a healthy series. Looking at your schedule, you're going to be in our neck of the woods in late April. You're going to race at Virginia International Raceway up in Danville, Virginia, which is from Richard and Seth and I, just, you know, a little over an hour drive. Tell us about that event and what we can expect from that.
Well, you might have to come out and say hi, first of all.
Well, yeah, we'll have to do that.
We're all about in person. But, yeah, I'm excited to get back to Virginia. Last year was actually the first time that my schedule took me there. And, you know, it's just one of those epic and historic tracks that still exist here in the U.S. that every driver's wanted to get their hands on. You know, my event there last year didn't really end that well. I ended up in an incident and totaled a Porsche going backwards into a wall at about 130. Of course, it wasn't my fault. You know, I mean, any driver can come up with a list of excuses that completely takes us off the hook. But so that's where I left off at VIR. So I'm excited to go pick up again and have a successful weekend. It's definitely a track that our new Porsche Cayman should do really well at. So
your races are typically timed events. How long are they?
They are. They're a 1 hour long race. I mean, we typically have race. We'll always have two events per weekend.
So okay, so you'll have Saturday and a Sunday. Is that typically how it goes?
Yes, typically that's the routine.
And what other series will be sharing the weekend with you at VIR?
You know, I believe at VIR will be a program within World Challenge. There are so many other things going on. We have the TC and TCR class that'll be racing. We have the GT4 class. And then there's the GT3 class.
Sounds like a terrific weekend for race fans.
For sure. And, you know, one of the other attributes is how relevant and accessible it is for the fans. You know, I don't know many other racing series where, you know, with a general admission ticket, you can get right into our garage area. You can come right up into the areas of the team and touch and feel the cars and talk to the drivers and team owners, and just really immersive and awesome experience.
Well, I tell you what, you've got me interested. I may have to take a trip up there that Saturday.
Well, we'll swap some information. We'll make sure we get you in there and taken care of, and come enjoy a weekend with us at TRG.
We appreciate that. We'll look forward to that.
All right, now, Richard, do you like to chime in?
Yeah. Hey, Derek, how's it going?
Very good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good, thanks. So I'm always interested by the mentality of race drivers, and I read a lot of biographies on the racing drivers and the makeup of a race car driver. And, you know, I think one of the things that you probably see more in your series is you interact with a lot of drivers, and, you know, you have a lot of teammates that you race with, and you race against a lot of drivers out there. And one of the big things that a race driver has is a lot of confidence. But have you ever been in a situation, whether it be with a teammate or a competitor following them round, and you've been, he's too good for me, I can't do that. You know, that guy's on another level to me.
You know, I think as a race car driver, you put yourself in a mode where you don't go there. You find it motivating when you surround yourself with people that are better than you, and it ups your game. I think that's part of what I really love about it. I love to be around a competitor that's got something figured out that I don't, and I can strategically try to learn from him or her and apply it, and if it works well, find a way by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's again, it's, you know, there's no reason why you can't do the same thing that they're doing. You know, we're all, in theory, we're all human. We all have, you know, two arms and two feet in most cases, and you know, can do a pretty damn good job with it. But yeah, it's interesting to see what sets people apart from each other and the mentality that they choose to sort of, you know, distinguish the two. But one thing I always like to ask drivers, and, you know, you read, again, you read a lot of these books and you read about some of the drivers, but have you ever found yourself, I guess what some drivers and what athletes call in the zone, where you're almost like you're driving in an almost like a subconscious method?
Absolutely. I think that's part of what happens in race car driving, or really in any extreme sport. Mm-hmm. You know, any sport where there's some healthy level of fear involved, I think your brain shifts modes where you're not 100% aware of everything that's going on. And I think that's when you get into that zone. And those are the drivers or athletes that have that, you know, from the outside looking in, ability to like flip a switch and somehow be at 102%. You're not sure how they got there, and if you ask them, they're not sure how they got there either. It just kind of happened.
Yeah, I mean, there's the famous case of Ayrton Senna. I think it was Monaco in the 80s where he actually stopped the car because he was, you know, he said he wasn't in control of the car. He wasn't, you know, he didn't feel like he was driving the car. I mean, I certainly don't get that, you know, driving to work every morning. There's plenty of times where I'd like to stop the car on the side of the road and not carry on, but probably for different reasons there.
Absolutely. There's actually a really interesting book that I've read that kind of addresses that whole concept. It's called The Rise of Superman by Stephen Kotler. And he's done this whole study of extreme athletes and how they're able to tap into that
Yeah, I've always been interested with endurance racing when you've got to rely on teammates for the stints where you're not in the car. You know, and occasionally you'll see a thing where, you know, one guy gets the car into the lead, and then the next guy gets in there and absolutely, you know, dumps the car into the gravel trap. You know, so there has to be a level of trust between teammates. But how nail biting is it, you know, knowing that you've driven a good stint to turn that over? I mean, do you like, you know, watch, or do you just maybe set back and say, let me just see what happens?
It definitely can be nail biting, and that's, you know, where, you know, I've been very thankful being as close with Kevin Buckler and with TRG as I have been, because he doesn't tend to put you in a bad situation. You know, there was even that year where we had, you know, the lineup for Daytona was not coming together. We needed some more guys. And I know there was a million guys standing there that could have just paid and bought a seat, but he wasn't willing to put them in the car. He wanted to make sure that, you know, between me and Max Riddle and Eliseo, we had a team where everybody could rely on everyone. I think also race car drivers are pretty realistic. Yeah, it's hugely frustrating to see the positions go backwards or to see an incident, but we also realize it could happen to us just the same. So we're always trying to support our teammates and do the best that we can. I think it's also become, you know, especially with the way that the rules currently are, that there's very clear roles expected from drivers. You know, with multi-driver racing now, there's, you know, you depending on the series, right, you may have a gold driver and a bronze driver paired. You know, the bronze driver knows he's not supposed to be as fast as the gold. He's just supposed to make really good decisions, keep the car in the lead lap and clean and hand it on over. And when he does that, he's going to get really great praise from the team and the other driver. So it's, you know, just a matter of trusting your teammates and trusting your team owner and doing what's in your box, you know. Sometimes what's behind door number one is just perfect, and you're better off not looking behind door number two.
Yeah. Well, you know, what exactly is the process from, like, say, moving up from a bronze driver to a silver driver? Is it just laps run, or does it have to do with results?
It has to do with results and with age as well. And I'm not positive that age where you just kind of automatically can become and stay a bronze, but you know, basically, if you haven't won a championship or a major series, you're going to remain a bronze and maybe a silver. You know, I've been lucky to stay where I am. I've won some professional races. I've won a team championship. Haven't won an individual championship. I've been runner-up a few times. And, you know, so I've been able to stay a bronze, which has been beneficial with the way that the rules are this year. So it's really just it's up to the FIA and the people there that are looking at that stuff.
Is there any kind of process in place where somebody can protest their ranking and say, no, I need to be better, or I need to be, or you're putting me in unfamiliar territory, or is it just what FIA say goes?
Yeah, there is a protest process that you can do, but like I said, in my case, I'm certainly happy to be a bronze, and my goal is to be the fastest, most professional bronze that you can be.
Big fish in a small pond.
Exactly.
Last year, Derek, you attended your first Indy 500, if I remember correctly. Are there any other marquee races that you have plans to attend, whether as a fan or maybe in a dream one day as a driver?
I very badly want to find myself back in the 24-hour Daytona. That's one of my very favorite events, and I really want to have a chance to go win one of those watches as a driver. I also would like to be back to Le Mans. If you guys followed Fast Life at all, you saw that I did get to race there in the Aston Martin Festival and got to taste victory there, but I'd really like to do it in the big 24-hour race. And Spa is another one that I really would like to get to.
Have you had an opportunity to run at Sebring?
Not at the 12-hour. I've had some other events there. I actually, when I was running back with Skip Barber in Formula Dodge, that was first national-level Barber Dodge events, and I've always enjoyed that track with TRG. We've done lots of events and testing there. And yeah, would love to find myself in the 12 hour, you know, in a perfect world. I'd eventually like to have a whole crack at the four race North American Endurance Championship. That's on the list of things to do and a goal that I'm putting out there for sure.
Well, good. Derek, let the fans know how they can keep up with you on social media.
Yeah, absolutely. We love to interact with the fans, by the way, so we love for them to track us down. And DerekDeBoerRacing.com is a personal website. It has all the links to all of our social media, but probably the easiest is FastLife.tv. It's got links to the Amazon Prime channels for seasons one and season two, and it's got all of our social media handles, both for me and my wife, who's also got a blog that she's running now, and we're all on there. So that's the best way. And we love hearing feedback. We love getting comments on the Amazon Prime channel and all that. So I welcome that, and it kind of keeps us going. Everything's not always as bright and rosy as it looks. This is a difficult path to go down, and there's lots of hurdles. Some high fives and support here and there help a great deal.
Just checked your Twitter feed. So that's got a lot of information on it as well.
Absolutely.
Derek, before we let you go, I want you to take a few moments and plug your sponsors, because we all know how important that is in racing. I know Adobe Wineries is one of them.
Yeah, what a great one, TRG. I just keep joking that I'm like a kid. He lets me drive these amazing race cars, and he's got this awesome winery too, so we get to enjoy lots of good Adobe Road wine on the side. So with that, part of my life is in the automotive world too, so we've got some partners that both make life easier in the dealership, and they also help us out on the racetrack, and that's Pastime GPS and a data system from Auto Lead Star. They're really, really great partners.
Derek DeBoer drives the number 17 Porsche Cayman for the Racers Group in the Pirelli Challenge GT4 America Series, and he's also the star of Fast Life. We're going to go to a commercial break right now. Driver Circus on Hoobazoo Radio.
Do you owe back taxes to the IRS or state? The secret to avoiding the IRS nightmare is to seek professional representation. My friends at Security Tax Associates provide the most cost-effective and ethical representation in the industry while helping to avoid seizures, levies, and wage garnishments. Security Tax Associates is here to ensure that the appropriate steps are taken to permanently eliminate any possibility of future tax burdens once and for all. For a free, no-obligation consultation, contact Security Tax Associates, 844-779-4177. That's 844-779-4177. 844-779-4177. Or visit them at securitytaxassociates.com.
Welcome back to Drafting the Circus on the Hoobazoo Radio Network. You've been listening to Derek DeBoer, who was a fantastic guest tonight. Unfortunately, his audio cut out at the end there, but I did want to go ahead and plug his sponsors for him. He drives for the Racers Group. Fast Life TV is his television show. Check out his website at fastlife.tv. Adobe Wineries, Pastime GRS, LaSalle Solutions, and BRM Chronograph all are sponsors of the car. So keep up with him at the Pirelli Challenge GT4 Series. So let's talk about this NASCAR race this weekend, right? So we're at Phoenix. Kyle Busch wins it. Very, very, uneventful end of the race, So, Seth Gray, take us through it.
Yeah, it was another race and yet another rules package for the Cup Series this weekend. This weekend they used the larger tapered spacer underneath the carburetor. So they had that, and they used, instead of using the aero ducts, they used brake ducts. But still, the new splitter and the new rear spoiler were all in place. And I thought it was a pretty good race again. Of course, typical Phoenix race. You're going to get one car hit the magic setup, and it's pretty much going to be the one to beat. And Kyle Busch pretty much had the car to beat, all weekend long. In fact, he won the double header there, won the Xfinity race on Saturday as well. But I think still we're seeing in this new package evolving as we go. They're learning it. Next week we go to California, and we'll see yet another variant of the it'll be more like Vegas when we go to California. They'll run the Aero Dux, they'll run the smaller tapered spacer, and of course the splitter and the spoiler are in effect. So and it's a 2 mile track, so hopefully we'll see a very competitive race there again, and these teams will again learn as they go. But Toyota came to the forefront again. Kyle Busch gets his first Cup win of the year, and he joins Denny Hamlin from Joe Gibbs as a winner also. And of course, that so far this year through four races, it's been the Joe Gibbs Racing in the Penske Show with Keselowski and Logano taking Atlanta and Las Vegas. So, I thought the Fords were strong again. And the Toyotas as well. Chevrolet still seems to be third in class right now. Still didn't have that. Hadn't had, other than Daytona, they really haven't had really anybody to jump out. So, but we know Kyle Larson runs well there, and maybe look for the number 42 Chevrolet to come to the forefront and see what he can do. I think Chase Elliott will also run well there too. But I'm sure Chevrolet camp is a little bit concerned based on what they've seen in these last three races.
Well, so, certainly, yeah, because I thought for a while in the closing stages, Blaney had him covered, but apparently his car was not as good on a long run as Kyle Busch, and we had a long green run at the end of the race.
Actually, Blaney was two laps short on fuel, so that was all him fuel saving.
Yeah.
Okay. My bad.
But going back to Chevrolet and its struggles, I will say this, though. There isn't much that Chevy can point to as a positive, at least from this past weekend. I mean, you had Jimmy Johnson scoring a top 10 on just his second one this season. Otherwise, Chase Elliott, he started on the front row. He got penalized for jumping the start, beating Blaney to the line, despite doing a pass-through penalty at one of the longest and slowest pit roads on the circuit. Chase still got back on track ahead of Blaney on the lead lap and was able to stay on the lead lap until the first caution. He had enough speed to do that, despite essentially being in the worst air of the entire field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is, like I said, Chase has been the standard bearer for Chevrolet, was last year with three wins. And, of course, Chevrolet only had four last year. Of course, we know Austin Dillon won the season opening Daytona 500. So, yeah, I would expect Chase and probably Larson to again, carry the Chevy banner. When we go out to California, we just have to wait and see. But, yeah, it's I tell you what, it's, I'm still some head scratching there because, when you compare it to what, Ford came out with the new new body style this year, basically a new with the bodies are essentially the same, just a few little differences in them. But Ford came with the Mustang, and they have not missed a beat. They're still right there as competitive as they were last year with the Fusion. So I'm sure the Chevrolet camp is a little concerned right now and working hard to kind of change it. And I don't expect them to stay behind the eight ball the entire season. I imagine I would hope they would
Well, there's something curious that I've noticed.
To work and make some gains.
There's been something curious that I've noticed going back to Atlanta and even at Vegas as well. You have a lot of the Chevy teams running very, very well in practice. And these are teams that don't normally run all that well, or at least haven't in recent years. Richard Childress Racing, JTG Doherty, etc. And they start the race, at least the first stage, very well. And then it's like they fall off the face of the earth. I mean,
they fall off after after a long green run. Yeah, I've noticed that too. And I will say this, and you just brought it up. Austin Dillon had a really fine run going this weekend at Phoenix. He was maintaining a strong fifth position and looked like he was going to be in line for a top five. And he ran out of gas late in the race and had to come to pit road, and it spoiled a good day for the three team. But and I'm sure they were encouraged. That team was encouraged by the way they ran, even though they didn't get the finish that they wanted.
And it was curious too that he ran out of fuel, because he was the only one to run out of fuel, and he came to pit road 8 laps later than Ryan Blaney and some of the others that were very close on fuel.
I heard some concern by some of the crew chiefs that they were unsure about what kind of gas mileage they would get with this new package, the higher downforce package. They thought that they would get poor gas mileage.
Which they expect at some tracks, other tracks they think it might be the same or a non-factor because the tire wear, like Auto Club, Darlington, Atlanta, etc. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they were
how many teams entered into Phoenix? Was it 36?
It was 36 exactly.
Okay, so 35 managed to work out the fuel mileage. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
I get it. Yeah. You're right in the fact you say the new aero package does create some unknowns. But
well, and two, you don't know if they got the car completely full on the last pit stop too.
No, they couldn't have.
They could have been some fueling issues during the last pit stop, and then that falls on the pit crew there if that indeed is the case. But other teams were in fuel save mode. They knew it was going to be close, but like you said, he was the one that ran out. So I'm sure they. I'm sure that, and Richard, you and I both know that was probably a big topic of concern around the campus on Monday. And I'm sure they jumped into it and took fuel cells apart and gas cans and everything else apart, trying to find out why that happened.
I mean, the other end of that, though, is let's think about a couple of other variables. It's, Blaney may have different shift points than a lot of the other drivers running a place like Phoenix, because Phoenix is a unique track that creates different shift points for every driver when they're on it, when they're not, how high they run the RPMs before they decide to move through. But I'm kind of wondering, who's to say that Blaney was even trying to save to begin with? I mean, when you really look at it, you never really expect a full run to go without a caution. So you're going to go for maximum track position because you anticipate that caution late, especially in NASCAR lately.
Yeah, and typically if you follow the script, so to speak, there's typically a caution inside the last 25 to 28 laps at Phoenix, which it did not happen this particular race. But, listening to some of the radio chatter during the race, Austin Dillon was actually in fuel cell mode too. They were conversing about that over the radio. So he knew he had an issue, and he was trying, even though he was trying to save and maintain fifth spot too. So like I said, so many variables involved too. You don't know if they team got the car full or what. And then, like you said, the driving style of the driver plays a big part in it too. Some drivers used to shift at Phoenix, but I haven't heard them doing that in the last couple of years out there with this newer package they got. But several years ago they would shift, but I think the last couple of years they've got away from that.
Just continuing on the news topic this week for NASCAR. Today they unveiled the 20 nominees for the Hall of Fame for 2020. The six new names this year are Tony Stewart, Jim Pascal, Marvin Panch. I'm sorry, I lost my list. Here we go. Sam Ard, Neil Bonnet, and Red Vogue. And six names, like I said, and that's because five went in last year, and Kirk Shelmerdine has been taken off the list this year.
Yeah, I find that surprising that Kurt is off because his contemporary, or one of them, Ray Evernham, is already in the Hall of Fame. And if you look at their stats, they virtually mirror one another. So, and of course, we know Ray is very deserving of getting inducted into the Hall of Fame. So too, I should think that Kurt is equally as deserving.
I mean, I would have argued that Kurt should have been part of the second or third class that got inducted, honestly, just given what he did for so long with Dale Earnhardt. So, it just kind of blows me away. I mean, it would have been kind of cool to see both Kirk and Ray put in the same class, but, you know, so it goes. Fun politics.
And they also announced the nominees for the Landmark Award. Edsel Ford II, Alvin Hawkins, Mike Helton, Dr. Joseph Mattioli, and Ralph Seagraves. Mm-hmm. Falling off the list this year for that award, Janet Guthrie and Barney Hall.
Okay, well, you know, and everybody you just mentioned is significant in the sport. Ralph Seagraves, obviously, he comes from bringing R.J. Reynolds into the sport back in the early 70s, which really changed our sport and brought it into the modern era. You've got Alvin Hawkins, longtime operator at Bowman Gray Stadium, one of the longest running venues in NASCAR, started out many, many years ago. And then you've got, who else did you mention on that? Mattioli.
Dr. Joseph Mattioli of Pocono Raceway.
Pocono Raceway, been around a long time. And a couple of the others, you know, of course, Barney Hall, you know, we know what he did for the sport with his work with MRN over the years. So always someone deserving in that thing. And, it, you know, you would think that class right there, I actually do kind of like the Baseball Hall of Fame, where you could induct several people from that group, you know, each year into it rather than just one. But at least we've got people to look forward to getting in for years to come.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, with that being said, let's move on to IndyCar. Joey Barnes just joined us. St. Pete opener, Joseph Newgarden wins the thing. A little bit of crazy stuff in qualifying that saw some pretty good cars at the back and some pretty slow cars in the middle. So, Joey, take us through the St. Pete Grand Prix.
Yeah, so we had kind of an interesting mix of talent at the front and the back of the grid. And I'll say this, in qualifying, I think, you know, amid all the stuff, like there was a few teams, Bourdais comes to mind, Marco Andretti, that didn't get a chance to even run a lap. But it can't be understated how well Dragon Speed kind of got on with qualifying. I know, not to, you know, get all crazy because it was just kind of a middle-of-the-pack qualifying effort, but that's certainly a good notch for a team that's never even set foot on an IndyCar grid before with a driver who doesn't have any experience in an IndyCar. And they were able to go out there and put together a solid 12th-place qualifying effort in their first-ever showing. So, you know, props to them on that. But, it was kind of a fun little race that had a little bit of everything, from strategy to just positioning, and obviously track position was key. But I think, some of the funner moments was obviously early on when Pulsitzer Willpower was able to duel with Felix Rosenqvist, the hotshot rookie that everybody's touting coming in, and rightfully so. Some really good moves between the two. But in the end, it was, like you said, Joseph Newgarden getting the win. He did it by having kind of a fun little middle stint on the Reds, able to kind of gap the field whenever, I believe it was Marco who was actually holding up second place. And he ended up putting a gap, and it was enough to extend for the duration of the race. But so we got Newgarden, Dixon, and Power. So your last two IndyCar champions, along with the Indy 500 champ, run 1-2-3. Felix Rosenquist, who later confessed that he was essentially running with one arm because he pinched a nerve or something of that nature for the last like 40 laps. Alexander Rossi, fifth. James Hinchcliffe, sixth. Good run for that team coming from ninth, and especially good considering that everybody welcomed Robert Wickens back to the track to visit this weekend, which was always fun. Simon Pagenaud, seventh. Rookie Colton Herta, eighth. Santino Ferrucci getting a ninth, his career best finish, which was pretty shocking. He came from 23rd on the grid, the biggest mover of the day. And Jack Harvey for Meyershank Racing getting his first top 10 ever in IndyCar. So some feel-good stories there at the bottom end of the top 10. Obviously, some of the rough news was there was some sort of engine issue. There was talk of it being a turbo issue at the Honda camp. Bourdais went out early with some engine issues, and then Ryan Hunter-Reay followed about eight laps later. So kind of interesting to see that.
It's kind of funny. The team's a little quiet about it. You know, Dale Coyne released a statement. They say Bourdais was, left the race with a non-team-related issue.
Yeah.
I really like the careful wording of that. Yeah.
I mean, you got to be careful in this day and age, right? Otherwise, things can change in a blink of an eye. But I'm kind of wondering off the backhand of this, and something that hopefully I'll get a chance to talk to with some people in COTA. I'm wondering if maybe it was something to do with an engine mapping. Maybe there was an engine mapping setting that was a little bit different. Every team gets a chance to do something different on that end whenever they talk to the Honda engineers or even the Chevy engineers and maybe change some of the context of the mapping. And I was kind of wondering if in some sort of way, if that had to either hinder the turbo or hinder the different parts of the engine. But we'll see. Hopefully I can get a chance to talk to somebody at COTA and figure that out. But I think what was kind of fun here in this whole thing was that middle stint talking about Newgarden when he was on reds. They elected to go for scuff reds early in their stint because everybody started, I believe everybody started on reds if I remember correctly, and then they switched to the primary black compound. But when he decided to move to the sticker reds and really got that gap in, all the talk was about the track surface not being adaptive to the reds because they were going to wear too quick. But, and I'm wondering if we'll see this at Long Beach, Toronto, and so on and so forth at other street circuits. If you're able to get those primaries out there on a hot, slick surface, because temperatures were soaring up to 118 degrees during the Indy Lights races, I'm kind of wondering, you lay enough rubber down in your first run or two, if you can feel more confident opting for the reds then because you feel like the fall off's going to be a lot less dramatic. Richard could probably take us through that one. But, I think that was kind of interesting from that standpoint. I thought it was brilliant work on not just – it wasn't just luck of the draw they came in on that and ended up with that. I mean, Tim Cindric played it to a T, knowing how traffic was planning out and essentially using a lapped car as a pick on pace, because with the way things were cycled, you would have thought that this was going to be Will Power versus Felix Rosenquist, pound for pound all the way through to the end. And somehow Newgarden gapped Dixon, who gapped Power, who got out of Rosenquist. You got to really question how that Chip Ganassi pit crew let Rosenquist fall from essentially battling for the lead to coming out in fourth place out of everybody with a miracle save coming out of the pits, because he pretty much got chopped by oncoming traffic and had a handful of wheel there. But going out of the pits into two. Yeah, I think we learned a lot about the IndyCar season in race one, but I honestly, at the same time, we've got more questions because I feel like we all get hyped up on Scott Dixon trying to go back-to-back. We get hyped up on Power. I know a lot of us picked him last week. Rosenquist is talented, and Rossi is that hotshot American, and somehow through it all, a lot of us have kind of missed Newgarden. Yeah. It's funny how he's – he's a defending champ two years ago, but the common theme among some of the paddock, not all, but some of the paddock, he just becomes kind of that forgotten guy. Like he got his accolades and we just thought that, okay, you got your accolades and you're going to move by the wayside. And clearly he showed that that's not the case this past weekend. So really interested to see how this season plays out. And I mean, maybe he's the guy that comes back. You know, he had that motto last year called defend the one. And unfortunately he wasn't able to do that, but maybe this year's that slogan reclaim the one in full effect.
I find it pretty interesting that for the second year in a row, we've had a rookie emerge in the first race. Last year was Robert Wickens, and well, this year we've got Rosenquist.
There's a difference between being a rookie and being a true rookie, right? Mm-hmm, I mean, right. Let's be honest. Like,
well,
Robert
all these
Wickens,
guys come with a degree of experience in other forms, Drew, but I think it's just how they've emerged. They've come, you know, in this first race and kind of emerged. We'll see what they do going forward.
I mean, talent translates, and you know, I mean, with somebody like Colton Herta doesn't have as much seat time and a lot of diverse stuff, mm-hmm. quite like Felix Rosenquist does. I mean, you look at somebody like Robert Wickens when he came over and wowed everybody last year. He came over from a very heavy DTM. Previous to that, he had open wheel experience.
Mm-hmm.
And Rosenquist, I think it's so funny. Me and a few friends were texting about this past weekend. So many people are like, oh, wow, Felix Rosenquist. It's like the world doesn't know who he is. They're about to. Actually, technically, the world knows. The United States didn't know. They're about mm-hmm. to, because the world knows that this kid should be alongside Lewis Hamilton in a Mercedes seat.
Mm-hmm.
And here he is. We're lucky enough to have him in IndyCar. Just Macau Grand Prix wins multiple times. Incredible resume on street courses, and that's why I still think he's going to win at Long Beach. You know, I just him on a street course is pure magic. Now, how does he adapt to ovals, and how does he adapt to? He's already run Indy Lights ovals and road courses, but how does that translate? Because on street courses, you don't bet against him. 9 times out of 10, he's going to be somebody that can bring it home.
You know, we talked about everybody but him last week in our IndyCar preview. You know, looking forward to this could be one of the most competitive IndyCar seasons ever. You know, we all talked about our favorites and who we thought would emerge, and it's you know, this guy could surprise us all.
Yeah, nothing will push a 5-time champion quite like having a rookie quite as fast as Felix, I'll tell you that much. So it'll be interesting to see how much that raises Scott Dixon's game, because he hasn't been pushed. I guarantee you this, he hasn't been pushed to this level since Dario. Period.
And
I'm just really interested to see how an older, wiser, more crafty veteran Scott Dixon handles that. Mm-hmm. So
Rossi,
yeah,
came
be interesting to see for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Rossi came in fifth, did he not? Didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, he got a top five. So, you know, that's pretty much you know, we had Rossi who was the man to beat in a lot of races last year. In fact, I believe I picked Newgarden to win last week, so
the yes. only one that didn't overlook him. Yeah.
There you go, Gray. Yep,
well, there you go. I'm one for one right now. Okay.
All right. Hey, let's move on to Formula One now. Richard, you yes. have 5.5 minutes.
Oh, so, well,
some breaking news. Just heard some breaking news as we're on the show, so I'll let you share it.
Yeah, unfortunately, the FIA race director, Charlie Whiting, passed away today in Melbourne ahead of the Australian Grand Prix. A shocking story to come out, you know, on the eve of the new season. Charlie had been the FIA race director for probably nearly over 20 years now, and instrumental in a lot of the things we see on a race weekend these days, not just from the action on that you see on track, but also the safety side. There's a lot of people that have made racing a lot safer, not just in Formula One. You know, the work that he did and guys like Sid Watkins as well have done have certainly had a knock-on effect in Formula One and IndyCar and NASCAR and, you know, lots of other race series. So, a real shock. And he was a polarizing figure at times for some of the calls that he made during a race, but it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a void going into this weekend, I think, and it's really going to hit people quite hard. He was, you know, very, very influential and very, very well-respected guy within the paddock, and it was quite often seen as the sort of calming influence there, so that is a shame. However, as we all know, you know, the racing series, the racing must go on, and first race of the season down in Melbourne, as it has been since 1996, I think it was, by 1 year. And yeah, it'd be great to get back out on the track, see the cars running again, get a real idea of where all the cars stack up based on, you know, post pre-season testing. Red Bull have fast tracked some of their upgrades and improvements that they had penciled in for China. They're now going to be available in Australia. Will Ferrari be ahead by a quarter of a second, as Mercedes have been saying? Will Mercedes have found some of that gap? You know, the most interesting battle is probably going to be the Formula 1.5, as people are calling it. You know, the battle for you know, fourth place up back in Constructors' Championships. Who's going to be the head of that pack? Is it going to be Haas, like you saw last year in Melbourne? Is it McLaren going to be there? Toro Rosso, Renault, Force India, not Force India, Project Force, Project Racing, or whatever they're called now, sorry. You know, will Williams still be languishing at the back there? Where are Alfa Romeo going to be with Kimi in the car? A lot of questions to answer, and it could be a very exciting weekend. Races, I think, around about 1 o'clock in the morning Eastern time on Sunday. So it's either a very early morning or a very late night for some people. But, yeah, you know, obviously it's all going to be overshadowed this weekend, unfortunately, by Charlie's passing. But
that's definitely, yeah. So, I imagine they've got somebody lined up to...
There is an assistant race director, yes.
Take his place. So, but, I mean, that's the last thing that guy had on his mind getting to Melbourne. It's like...
For sure.
You know, having that thrust into his lap, so hopefully that won't have any kind of adverse effect on the race. But I'm sure whoever they have is, you know, probably very skilled at it. But yeah, very, very sad to hear about, you know, Charlie, very unexpectedly passing away. Like I said, he's been a fixture with the series for years. So, but again, with every new season, there seems to be undue pressure on Ferrari to perform. You know, because. Well, because they're Ferrari.
Yeah.
But they've been pretty impressive in preseason testing. You know, the whole taking the gloss out of their paint, you know, to shave a few seconds off is but do you feel like Ferrari is for real this year? I mean, I know behind the scenes that it's been a bit of chaos for about 3 years now, but do you feel like maybe this year Ferrari finally gets it together and mounts an actual challenge?
They have to at some point, don't they? Realistically, you know, the momentum has certainly been building over the last couple of years, and what you see with Mercedes and when you saw with Red Bull prior to that, when they had their 4 and 5 years winning streaks respectively, they just look like they're ready to win, and they look set up and they look prepared and they execute well, you know. More than any other race series in the world, maybe Le Mans, but you know, Formula One is all about execution. It is about having the fastest car, but you've got to execute properly. And Mercedes have done that flawlessly. Red Bull did that flawlessly. Ferrari have always seemed to shoot themselves in the foot when it's come to that over the last few years. Maybe a little bit of their culture, I don't know. But you know, hopefully that's starting to turn, and you know, it'll be a great season, competitive season. And I don't think Red Bull are going to be far away. The Red Bull Honda package, I think, is going to be pretty competitive as well. I think Honda is slowly starting to up their game as well.
I mean, I look at this from a standpoint of also with Ferrari. You've got a Rivabene for so long who is really good. And not take nothing away from him, but there's a difference between a Rivabene and, you know, Benito that's over there. Or however he pronounces his last name, but I feel like when you're going up against Toto Wolff, you need a guy that's not emotional quite like what a Rivabene was. You need a guy who is focused on his own program, because you knew that a Rivabene still listened to the things on the outside. He could say we're focused on our own operation and inside, but if that's the case, he wouldn't have to defend the fact that he's always looking inside. Like, you don't say you're focused on the inside if you're listening to the outside nonsense. So, you know, at the end of the day, Ferrari hears everything. So it's a matter of having the right guy at the top of the leadership circle. And I feel like they've got it with Binotto in place. And, you know, if there is a year, this is it. Because let's remember, with Kimi gone, their last race winner and their last world champion is no longer a part of the program anymore. Yeah. And you're looking at now, what has it been, 13 years since they held a world championship? So
12.
Do it?
Seven, yeah, it was 2007.
Yeah, 12, okay.
12 years, yeah.
And we've never run in, since Formula One began, we've never had a one full decade, you know, whether it's 90 to 2000 or so on and so forth, you know, a decade at a time. We've never had a run where you've never had a Formula One champion that wasn't represented in the red overalls. This, if it doesn't change soon, we will, plain and simple. And I, at some point, the horseshoe doesn't stay with Mercedes. Plain and simple. They can run as well as they want to, but at some point, Bottas gets sick of it. Hamilton runs into bad luck. The most intriguing thing for me is, you know, what happens with Renault? Can Daniel Ricciardo be that person that really takes Renault to that next step? I don't think so early on, but I think you're going to see some gains out of them middle of the year.
Yeah. So no, I think that, you know, it started as... You know, there's been obviously the regulation changes this year, but as the regulations start to stagnate, you do tend to get a concertina effect on the grid dispersion, because teams, for a start, engineers start to move around and take ideas from one team to another, and the gains that you can find become smaller and smaller. So you're naturally going to have that, the field close up. But it's going to be interesting, but as I say, I would be very surprised if Ferrari aren't the dominant car. Well, not dominant, no, the fastest car, because they can be fast, and we all know they can shoot themselves. And God, I hope they don't. I really would love to see them, execute efficiently and boringly, if that's a real word. I'd love to see Ferrari just do the business.
They always start well. It's about how you finish, though.
Well, very true. But remember, the faster you are, the less room there are for improvements.
We'd all like to see Ferrari do well. But, guys, we are out of time. So we do have just enough time to go around the table and get one pick for the NASCAR race, one for the Formula One race. So I'll start with you, Gray.
I'm going to say Kevin Harvick at California. He breaks into the win column for the first time in 2019. And in the Formula One, I'm going to have to go with Vettel.
All right. And Seth, you are next.
For NASCAR, I'm going to go with Larson. And I'll go with Lewis Hamilton for F1.
All right. And then Richard?
Truex. And let's go with Verstappen. Let's go for a bit of a curveball there.
All right. And Joey?
Blaney and Leclerc.
Okay, so I'm going to go with Kyle Busch and Lewis Hamilton. Why not? So, guys, that's all the time we have. I want to thank you for tuning in to Hoobazoo Radio Network. I want to thank you, Seth, Joey, Gray, Richard, all you guys. I want to thank our guest, Derek DeBoer. Until next week, good night.
WHOOBAZOO.com. WHOOBAZOO.com. Enter website.